Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The need for an effective treatment for opioid addiction has never been more urgent. So far this year, 109 people have died from drug overdoses in Franklin County, compared to 74 deaths by this time last year. Most were fentanyl-related. Overdose deaths declined for the first time in 20 years nationwide, but in Franklin County, nothing changed. But there's no one-size-fits-all solution. Some believe that medication-assisted treatment is the answer. Others turn to the more traditional 12-step programs of Narcotics Anonymous. Still others subscribe to both strategies. Barbara Andreka Christou is the author of the forthcoming The Opioid Fix, America's Drug Crisis, and the Solution They Don't Want You to Have. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
The title of your book, it's The Opioid Fix, but I'm kind of more interested in the subtitle right now. Who is they?
Well, great question. I had initially actually had a different title, which was America's Addiction to Failing Treatment. But eventually the publisher suggested they. And so I was thinking also, you know, who is they? And I think ultimately they really refers to two groups of people. So the recovery community itself, believe it or not, such as 12-step groups or rehab centers that are based on 12-step groups, and then also the criminal justice system. And what I mean by those two groups specifically is they're the ones that have taken action affirmatively against people using medications for opioid use disorder, like methadone, buprenorphine, naltrexone, by, for example, not letting people talk in 12-step meetings or claim, you know, clean time, quote unquote, if they have been on these medications, or in the criminal justice system, forbidden people to resume drug court or kick them out of drug court if they have been on these medications. Now, there's other groups in the population that have also expressed relatively negative attitudes towards medication-assisted treatment, but they haven't necessarily been as directly negative towards those people using the medications as the 12-step groups and the criminal justice system. So, for example, you have insurance companies that have set prior authorization barriers for people trying to use the medications as well. There's a lot of other potential theys, as it were, but those two specific groups are the ones that I really talk quite a bit about in the book.
And is this, what do you think the resistance is a function of? Now, some people are going to say that what you're suggesting isn't really a fix for everybody. And so let's set that aside for a second. Are there cultural reasons for the resistance?
Oh, absolutely. And I don't think it's a fix for everyone. But what we do know is that among the options on the table, it's the best one. So the problem is you have several options. You have one that's clearly the winner in terms of the science, the clinical trials. And yet you have groups that are affirmatively telling people, don't take it, don't do it. You'll be punished if you use this treatment. And that's a serious problem.
What do they mean by you'll be punished?
Well, so for example, in the criminal justice system, I've interviewed several people who were kicked out of drug court and reincarcerated if they were on medications that were actually helping them succeed in recovery. You know, that's a more direct example of punishment, but I've also interviewed many people in 12-step groups who weren't able to speak during the meetings or who weren't allowed to sponsor someone, even if they hadn't misused heroin in a long time or some kind of, you know, whatever their drug was previously, they were still essentially told you're not good enough. You're, you know, just another drug addict because you're using these medications, even though those people would tell me, you know, I'm not the same person that I used to be. I'm not homeless. I'm, you know, holding down a job. Mm-hmm. I'm doing really well. And yet I'm being looked at as if I were still misusing drugs simply because I'm on these medications.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about treatments for people who are addicted to opioids today. Overdose deaths declined for the first time in 20 years nationwide, but in Franklin County, nothing's changed. So far this year, 109 people have died from drug overdoses, mostly associated with fentanyl, compared to 74 deaths by this time last year. My guest right now is Barbara Andreka Christou. She is the author of the forthcoming The Opioid Fix, America's Drug Crisis, and the Solution They Don't Want You to Have. If you have a question or comment, You can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So let's talk about what these fixes are. There's more than one. You mentioned three approved by the FDA. Methadone is familiar to people from decades past, and then naltrexone, and then buprenorphine. Tell us why these, what these do.
Sure. So what's really fascinating to think about is that all mammals, including, of course, humans, have opioid receptors in the brain. And we have, as humans, for tens of thousands of years used opioids. So our biological networking is really designed to respond to opioids, which is in part why they're so addictive when they're misused or used at high doses. Now, these opioid receptors, there's actually a benefit to them, which is that we are able to target them in treatments. So that means pharmaceutical companies for decades now have been able to go and design medications that specifically target those receptors. And methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone all target those receptors, but they do so in slightly different ways. So methadone and buprenorphine activate the receptors, those opioid receptors, and by activating them, they prevent cravings, but they also prevent withdrawal symptoms. And withdrawal symptoms can make people feel really sick, like they've had just the worst flu ever. And obviously that can prevent them from continuing in recovery if they know that, you know, down the street, someone's selling heroin that will make that, you know, in quotation marks, flu go away instantaneously, essentially. So that's the benefit of those medications. Now, they are actually opioids, but even though they're opioids, they don't, if they're used at the right dosage, if they're prescribed properly, they don't give people euphoria. And the other thing is that people who regularly have misused something like oxycodone or heroin, they've developed a really high tolerance to opioids. So even if they were to use methadone or buprenorphine differently than prescribed, oftentimes they still wouldn't experience euphoria because they have such a high tolerance. And those just aren't as strong an opioid as the things that the person used to abuse. So that's buprenorphine and methadone. Now, buprenorphine itself relative to methadone is kind of special, and it's considered safer because it has something called a ceiling effect, which is just really fascinating. Essentially, at a certain dosage, your brain will not be activated anymore. You can take more and more and more and more buprenorphine, and your brain, there just won't be any additional benefit from it. So really, there's no intrinsic rationale for taking more buprenorphine than necessary. On the other hand, if you do continue to take methadone, your brain will respond more and more and more, which is why people may overdose on methadone and why it's highly regulated. So buprenorphine is considered a slightly safer alternative, but both are very, very important and effective tools. And methadone, especially for people with really severe opioid use disorder, it's stronger than buprenorphine. It can prevent those cravings and severe opioid use disorder a little bit better. So it's still a very important option on the table. Now, naltrexone operates very differently. It's not an opioid at all. It just completely blocks those receptors. You can imagine that, you know, if there's a puzzle piece in the brain, that's the opioid receptor, and buprenorphine and methadone are fitting right in, just activating it a little differently. Naltrexone is essentially just covering up that puzzle piece. Nothing else is going to fit in. So it's just a complete blocker. And as a result, it's not a controlled substance. Really, anyone can prescribe it. And yet, despite that fact, it's also really underused, which is just really bizarre and interesting. There's just absolutely no reason for it to be underused. So those are the three important tools on the table. Now, what's also important to know is that there's different formulations of these. So for example, buprenorphine, there's a version that you can take daily at home. It's a pill or film you put under the tongue. There's also a once a month injection that lasts all month. And there's also now a 6 month surgical implant that just sits in your arm and slowly releases buprenorphine over time. Now, naltrexone, there's an oral version, and then there's a more effective relative to the oral version, extended release version, again, a once a month injection, and then it just lasts all month. So there's different, of course, cost barriers associated with each of those. Some are more expensive, some are less expensive, some may be covered by Medicaid, some might not be. But it's really important for people who do want to get on a treatment to know about all of these options and pick which one is going to be best for them.
you mentioned that some people see it as just becoming addicted to another drug. And I kind of want to understand this. So if I'm taking naltrexone, it blocks those receptors. I'm not getting high, but I'm also not having all the bad side effects of withdrawal. Am I getting addicted to naltrexone? And then, in other words, if I go off of it, do I just revert back to where I was before I started?
Well, so let me kind of stop you there, because okay. I think a lot of this is an issue of definitions.
Okay.
So what does addiction actually mean? Addiction is the compulsive use of something despite negative consequences. And that phrase, despite negative consequences, is absolutely critical. Okay. Otherwise, I would tell you, you are addicted to breathing because you're compulsively breathing.
Uh-huh.
Right. But, you know, it's not a negative thing to breathe. Right. I wouldn't say you're addicted to it. There's a negative assumption that goes along with the idea of addiction, right? So the issue with methadone and buprenorphine in particular is that people will say, oh, it's just another addiction, another drug. But it's not, because they're using these things in a way that's actually benefiting them. If someone is misusing oxycodone or heroin, there's a lot of negative effects. They're not able to hold down a job. Maybe they're not able to take care of their family. They're dropping out of school. They're falling asleep at work. Whatever. There's a whole slew of things. Oh, and also potentially overdosing. Mm-hmm. If on the other hand, someone is using methadone or buprenorphine as prescribed, then they're actually going to be having a lot of positive effects in their life. And we know that, like, without a doubt, we have so many studies showing this. They're less likely to relapse. They're about 50% less likely to have an overdose. They're more likely to hold down a job. They're less likely to be reincarcerated. These are all really, really positive effects. Now, if I just suddenly take the medication away from them tonight and say, oh, no more, are they potentially going to go back to misusing? Are they potentially going to relapse again? Yes. And that's a problem. But the problem doesn't say to me, don't give them the medicine. The problem is actually the opposite. It's don't arbitrarily take away the medicine. And that's no different from other fields of medicine, right? Mm-hmm. So if I'm taking antidepressants or anti-anxiety medicine daily, I may be functioning really well. It's really good. We wouldn't say, oh, you're addicted to that antidepressant or that anti-anxiety medicine just merely because you take it daily. Now, if I took it away from you, might you suddenly start feeling depressed or anxious again? Yes. But that, again, is just a reason to continue taking the medication. And, you know, maybe eventually you'll stop it, but let's not make it an arbitrary forced stopping. Let's make it a decision to stop when you're ready, when the physician agrees that you're ready.
Okay, so you go into a regimen of buprenorphine or methadone or naltrexone with the idea of eventually, under a doctor's care, moving off of that. Eventually.
Not necessarily.
Okay.
No, I would say that
it depends.
There's a big misconception that you have to move off of them. And again, I think it just okay. comes down to stigmatization of this particular health condition, because when someone goes on, you know, hypertension medicine or insulin or an antidepressant, we don't, you know, from the get-go say, well, I hope you're already planning when you're going to get off. Instead, mm-hmm. we find out, are they doing better? We congratulate them if they're doing better. We just try to support them in taking the medications. And that's really how it should be here. So some people will get off of them and some people will stay on them potentially their whole lives. And that should be fine, because on balance, the benefits of staying on them far outweigh the risks of staying on them.
And so you said that you're not against therapy, talk therapy, or the 12-step program, those kinds of approaches to this, in addition to medically treating it. Do you think it's important that there be another component to recovery?
I think it, first of all, I'm definitely not against them. Mm-hmm. They're very potentially useful tools. Especially if you think about the fact that so many people with a history of substance use have a history of trauma. So we know that people with a certain amount of adverse childhood experiences are more than 4,000 times more likely to become injection drug users. It's quite possible, in fact, that the trauma affects their brain in such a way that they may not be able to really experience joy or pleasure for a long time. And then they take an opioid and they're like, whoa, that's the first time I've ever felt good. So, I mean, there's a very strong relationship between trauma and these substance use issues, which suggests that a lot of people will need counseling, because counseling is really helpful for people with trauma. But with that said, it's not a one-size-fits-all package. There are some people who don't necessarily need counseling. There are some people who will benefit from going to 12-step groups. How so? I mean, not necessarily because there's something magical in the steps themselves, mm-hmm. but rather because they're expanding their social networks to include people who aren't drug users. They're having moral support. They're seeing that someone can recover. They're having that very visible inspiration. But again, it doesn't necessarily help everyone. And some people may not like them. Some people may balk at the spiritual nature, for example, of these groups that often are meeting in the basement of a church, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really a question of what works for that person. And what I argue against in the book is when you are forcing all of these things on people. I really strongly believe in person-centered care. That's what we do in all the other fields of medicine, where we say, here are the options, what is going to work best for you, rather than saying you have to do X, Y, and Z, even if you only want to do X.
And a lot of that, it's a function of it being mixed up with the criminal justice system.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, the criminal justice system is just fascinating because it's essentially a healthcare system unto itself that we never think about. But a lot of times people who are diverted from incarceration, either they're going into something like a drug court or probation, they are told, you know, you need to do the following things, and it's a one size fits all. And I think much of that has to do with the difficulty of individualized healthcare decision making in a system where you have very few physicians. You know, when I've studied drug courts, which is something I've done pretty extensively, I rarely ever see a physician. I mean, it's incredibly rare. You usually have the vast majority of the decision makers on that team are people with a criminal justice background. Typically, you might have a counselor, and counselors, again, are great, and obviously they're trained in counseling, but they may not necessarily know the best practices with respect to something like medication.
We are talking about strategies for recovery from opioid addiction. My guest right now, and she's going to stay with us for the hour, is Barbara Andreka Christou. She is the author of the forthcoming The Opioid Fix, America's Drug Crisis and the Solution They Don't Want You to Have. We're going to hear other points of view coming up in the program. We certainly want to hear from you if you have experience. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. 109 people have died already this year from drug overdoses in Franklin County. That's compared to 74 deaths by this time last year. Most were fentanyl-related. Overdose deaths declined for the first time in 20 years nationwide, but Franklin County, nothing's changed. Some believe that medication-assisted treatment is the answer for opioid addicts. Others turn to the more traditional 12-step programs of Narcotics Anonymous. Still others subscribe to both strategies. Still with us is Barbara Andreka Christou. She's the author of the forthcoming book, The Opioid Fix, America's Addiction Crisis and the Solution They Don't Want You to Have. Catherine Drabiak is an assistant professor in the College of Public Health and College of Medicine at South Florida University. Her research advises a cautionary approach to medication-assisted treatment. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you for having me.
What do we mean by a cautionary approach? You're not against it. Define what you mean by that.
So there's a number of things that that I would advise when we're talking about treating people who have opioid use disorder. And the biggest thing that I want to point out is that the way that we've looked at this recently in the past few years, we really collapsed a lot of populations together. So traditionally, we thought about people with using the term addiction. So things like people who were injection drug users using heroin. And this change in labeling has collapsed people who were using opioids, who started using them based on a prescription from their physician. So it's changed the population of who we're talking about. And that also has implications for how we're treating people and the evidence for what types of methods work to treat people. And so I think it's important for people that are either going through this or have a loved one going through this, is asking the question, what really is going to be compassionate, person-centered recovery? And that depends on a number of different things that we really aren't being asked when we see this this move to put a lot of people on medication-assisted treatment, sometimes indefinitely.
What should be asked? Are you there? Okay. We're going to work on Catherine Drabiak from... I'm sorry, Catherine. You were cut off there. So I asked you what was being asked. What should be asked?
What should be asked is, what's the evidence that this type of treatment actually works? So federal policy from the National Institute on Drug Abuse and the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration is very clear. They say, let's promote medication-assisted treatment, let's extend this to more people and give more people access, that it is successful. So part of what I was delving into in my research is, well, what metrics say it's successful? How do we know? How are people measuring this, right? And part of one of the biggest things that we'll hear is that it decreases overdoses, or that it decreases relapse. So the next question is, well, by how much? And so that was one of the kind of the startling things that I found, is that many people who are enrolled in medication-assisted treatment are still actively abusing other substances. So they might decrease some of the other drug use, but they're still using other drugs. So that raises the question of, is it actually helping them? Is it improving the quality of their life? Are they able to hold down a job? Are they still embroiled in the criminal justice system? All of these questions that come with that.
Listeners, we just had an accident with the calls. Please call back 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sorry about that. Dr. Barbara Andreka Christou, what is the evidence? How do you respond to that?
Oh, well, I think the evidence for opioid use disorder, it's crystal clear. I mean, there's no doubt about it, right? The World Health Organization says it's an essential medicine. The United Nations calls for it to be used in all prisons. Every federal agency at this point, from the FDA to SAMHSA to NIDA, they're all calling for expansion. I think what the doctor there was referring to is something called polysubstance use, where people have multiple substance use disorders, and this indeed is very common. And there's an active debate in the scholarly literature right now with respect to, well, what do you do for those other substance use issues? But I've never seen any strong evidence that merely because someone continues to, let's say, use marijuana or alcohol or cocaine, that we should remove the treatment that's working successfully for the opioid use disorder. In fact, right now, a lot of the literature is suggesting that what may be the best thing to do is what's called a low barrier approach, which goes contrary to what was done, let's say, 10 years ago, which is, even if you are a polysubstance user, even if you do have these other issues, we don't punish you by taking away your opioid use medicine. So historically, there used to be this idea that unless you have absolutely no other drug in your system, we won't give you methadone or buprenorphine. And that's just really kind of not the idea that's percolating right now in the scholarly literature. It's more, let's continue to treat the opioid use issue with what we know is the best treatment for opioid use disorder, and let's then find something else for the others. And one thing I should add here, so alcohol use disorder is actually treatable, in fact, by naltrexone. So naltrexone was one of its initial approvals was for the treatment of alcohol use disorder. So someone who has both alcohol and opioid use disorder, that may be a really good option for them. Now, let's say they have opioid use disorder and cocaine use disorder. There's no medication for cocaine use disorder. There is one for opioid use disorder. So then you want to think about, well, what's a very comprehensive approach of other things we can also add on to address the cocaine issue? And that may be things like counseling. It may be some kind of residential rehabilitation. It may be the 12-step support groups. So I do think the doctor brings up a really important issue of polysubstance use is common and needs to be addressed when it is the case, but I don't think there's any evidence to suggest the way to address it is to remove the treatment for the opioid use disorder.
I'm going to turn to a caller right now. Pam in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Pam.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Very well, thank you. Go ahead.
Well, thank you for addressing such an important topic. I'm an attorney that works with Family Recovery Court, which is a court for families who have been separated from their children because of their drug addiction problems. And I'm familiar with other drug courts that are more in the criminal area, but I just, in defense of all of this, I feel like we really approach this with a holistic approach. We have a treatment team, the attorneys on the team, along with other people who have expertise. We do refer to doctors, and we use combinations of medically assisted treatment, as well as group counseling, individual counseling. As your speaker said, there's a huge amount of trauma associated with these patients. Their issues are quite complex, and at least for Family Recovery Court, it's not an either-or situation. Medically assisted treatment is definitely part of our tool, our bag of tools that we have available.
Pam, so how do you, I just want to interrupt you just for a second, and I apologize, but how do you know what's right for what person?
Well, we meet twice a week, and you have to work with each patient. So they get referred to a doctor, they get referred for an assessment, a lot of the people we work with are the healthcare professionals who work with them regularly, and the counselors. They have a recovery coach. You know, there's input from many, many sources. And then we also obviously include the client and what the client or defendant, but they're the client in this context, defend. They let us know what they're comfortable with, what has worked for them. A lot of times it's a matter of getting down to what is their trauma that they are experiencing that caused them to go into this addiction. And to say that, oh, well, Franklin County hasn't gone down, let me tell you something. Our court is now swamped. There was a time when we were begging for people, but now we are swamped. So I don't know why the numbers aren't going down, except I can tell you that from our perspective as treatment, we are working very hard. We are having fairly good success rates, but it takes a long time.
Well, I'm sorry, Pam, if that, you know, when I make that point that it sounds like nobody's doing anything, because we do know that people are like you out there working really, really hard on this. So I hope you know that that's not the point of that. So,
but my point was the courts are actually open to, you know, your guests said at the beginning that if you do drug court, then you can't do this.
Well, some drug courts, that is the case, though.
That may be.
Yeah.
But
not in Franklin
County.
I also
want people to know that in Franklin County, we have a more holistic approach,
okay,
which I'm very proud of because we've worked so hard to get to that.
Thanks for your call. I appreciate it. And thanks for your work.
Thank you.
You bet. Catherine Drabiak, what you write that that the side effects of the treatments, the medically assisted treatments, are something to be concerned about. How so?
So one of the things I think to keep in mind when we're talking about any type of medication, whether it's a medication for insulin or a blood pressure medication, there's always side effects. And so there's multiple ways of treating a particular medical problem. And when we're talking about looking at how to treat opioid use disorder, if it was going to the physician that caused the opioid use disorder in the first place, I think we should be asking more questions of, well, why are we replacing it with another opioid? Because we heard a lot of the, when opioids were first kind of flooding the market, we heard a lot of these claims that it doesn't cause euphoria, it's not habit forming, there's no dependence, and it really helps manage the symptoms that, patients need help with. Mm-hmm. So we hear very similar claims with either opioid agonist or partial agonist, methadone and buprenorphine, claims from federal agencies, so the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and all of these basically patient information booklets that they're getting, and information from physicians saying these drugs will not cause euphoria, they won't cause you to be dependent on mm-hmm. them, you'll still be able to function in your daily life and go to work. And what some of, first of all, what some of the literature is showing is actually the opposite, that patients are tired, they're experiencing depression. And part of what I looked at was some of the lawsuits and litigation against clinics because patients basically drove off from the clinic because they were impaired. So there's issues of impairment to the point of they're getting into motor vehicle accidents.
I wanted to let Dr. Andreka Christou respond to that. What about that research, Doctor?
I mean, certainly there's side effects to medications of any kind, right? Now, I think there's a big difference between the evidence that existed supposedly back, you know, 15, 20 years ago for analgesic opioids. There were, for example, there was a very, very small study that was essentially a research letter in a journal that was then blown up across the government, across healthcare providers claiming that opioid analgesics weren't addictive. That was just a miniature amount of scientific literature backing some of those claims those pharmaceutical companies were making that opioid analgesics are not addictive. On the other hand, if you look at something like methadone or buprenorphine treatment in particular for addiction, we're talking meta-analyses of hundreds of studies from all over the world going back decades now. Methadone, remember, has been around since 1972, and buprenorphine in the U.S. since 2000, two approximately, but in Europe even before then, there is just an incredibly different amount of scientific literature backing the fact that these medications decrease risk of opioid overdose and relapse relative to those claims that were before being made about the opioid analgesics. Now, as far as the side effects go, if you take too much methadone, you will nod off. That's known. I mean, it's an opioid, but someone who is properly taking it, who is prescribed the correct dosage, is not going to be nodding off. Naltrexone, we have known for some time that there is a risk of depression that goes along with it. After all, it's blocking the receptors in the brain that are associated with dopamine, and dopamine is the feel-good natural chemical. But again, it's all a balance, right? On balance, is a risk of depression, you know, a minor risk, relatively speaking, of depression okay if we're potentially preventing an opioid overdose? And the other thing to keep in mind is a lot of these people who get on these medications, this is not their first rodeo. The typical person actually just had an article recently come out examining how people start these medications. They're rarely, you know, just immediately that's their first choice. They've often tried lots of other things. They've tried residential rehab. They've tried 12-step groups. They've tried counseling, and none of it's working. And then finally, they take the medication and they feel better. And, you know, I think that most of the people who have done well on these medications will tell you that it's sometimes the first time they felt normal in years. So, you know, on balance, again, will they have some side effects? Sure. But the feeling of, wow, I felt normal for the first time in years, that's a really big benefit.
We are going to have to say goodbye to Catherine Drabiak, Assistant Professor of Public Health and Medicine at the University of South Florida. Thanks for your insights. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
We will continue our conversation. We're talking about medically assisted treatment for drug addiction and comparing it and contrasting it to the more traditional 12-step programs from Narcotics Anonymous. We have callers who have experience with both of these things, and we're going to hear from them as well. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. The need for an effective treatment for opioid addiction has never been more urgent. So far this year, 109 people have died from drug overdoses in Franklin County compared to 74 deaths this time last year. Most were fentanyl-related. Overdose deaths declined for the first time in 20 years nationwide, but not in Franklin County. Still with us is Barbara Andreka Christou. She's author of the forthcoming book, The Opioid Fix, America's Addiction Crisis and the Solution They Don't Want You to Have. Andy Albrecht is the executive director at the Counseling Center, Inc. in Portsmouth, which serves Adams, Lawrence, and Scioto counties. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
And April Caudill is the executive director of the Hope Resource Center in the Hilltop neighborhood. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You know, I'm going to go to some callers right away. I want to hear from, we have two points of view here that I want to get to. First of all, David in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Great. So I appreciate everybody's comments before me, and I definitely want to say this is, you know, as it's coming from an odd, non-judgmental point of view. Everybody's different. You know, some people may have a DUI or use medication from their mother's, you know, filing, you know, a medicine drawer and mm-hmm. never have problems again. So I have 8 years, 3 months, and 5 days clean. And I was grateful to go through treatment centers when medically assisted treatment wasn't really pushed heavily. I mean, all the treatment centers that I went to here in Columbus were basically, it was used as a detox medication. And that's what drives a lot of people not to start the path to recovery or sobriety is the fear of withdrawals. You know, within the past few years, you know, MAT being pushed so heavily, I think my personal view is that, you know, as a treatment center or counseling center or pharmaceutical company, you know, certain treatment centers here push 18-month you know, Suboxone protocols. Well, that allows them to, you know, say, yeah, we've had success for up to 18 months with some of our clients. But, you know, I'm not a doctor, but I just know definitely from being an addict in recovery is, you know, over that time, my body's naturally going to produce some type of resistance to lower doses. I'm going to have to be increased. And I've witnessed many friends, you know, come in and out of the rooms over the past years, and it just doesn't work. And what I always say to them is, you know, if you think you're free, if you think you're free from active addiction or whatever that case is, mm-hmm. you know, leave your medication at home and go on vacation. Mm-hmm. You, unfortunately, they experience the same horrific withdrawal that I experienced.
Okay. So, well, David,
yeah,
I'm glad you're in recovery. Congratulations on that. And I want to get a little feedback from Barbara Andreka Christou about that. So hang on. Barbara?
Yes. Hi. Thank you. Thank you for sharing. I mean, this is a very common topic that I hear brought up, which is, you know, long-term use. Ostensibly, it sounds bad, but all the literature has shown us, we actually have lots of studies that examine in two head-to-head comparison groups, a shorter duration of Suboxone versus longer duration, or shorter duration of methadone versus longer duration. And the longer duration always results in lower negative outcomes. Now, I think something that the caller was referring to, and this goes back to something I was saying earlier, which is, well, but what about when they stop using? They're fine when they're using the medication, and then suddenly they stop the medication, and then can they go on vacation and be fine?
Right.
Well, again, this is an issue with maybe they shouldn't stop that medication then if they're not doing well. And it certainly shouldn't be an arbitrary time that they pick to stop. And it's no different, like I said before, from telling someone, oh, really, you're better on your antidepressants? Well, let's test you out by taking away the antidepressants, see how you really are. I mean, we would never have that approach to other people with other healthcare conditions. We would say, if you still need to use those antidepressants, that's fine. Keep mm-hmm. using them. And if eventually you don't, that's fine, too.
And then I do want to get to our other guests, April Caudill and Andy Albrecht, but I want to take, thank you, David, for that call. I want to turn to Benjamin in Grove City now. Benjamin, you're on the air.
Hi, Ann. Longtime listener. Really love the show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to call in and say that I've been an addict for many, many years, and I've been on medication-assisted treatment for 12 years. So that's a really long time. And without it, my best guess is that I would be dead by now. And I have 5 children. And I finally am almost completely off of the medicine. I have not been ready until now. And I called in when the woman was talking about how they're not seeing any success rates. Well, my life is the only life I know, and it's successful. And that's basically all I wanted to say.
Well, Benjamin, congratulations. I'm so happy for you. And thank you for calling in and sharing your other point of view, and I appreciate that. Andy Albrecht, you've been doing in the business of this at the Counseling Center for a long time. You're seeing a lot of different cases down there. Tell us, we just heard two different points of view. Do they both sound familiar?
Yeah, they do, and I think what we're hearing and what I see almost every day is that the reality is everybody's different. I mean, I think sometimes where we make a mistake in the field is we have these kind of cookie cutter type approaches where an individual, is going to be on for X amount of months or X amount of times. And I think the reality is, and I can speak in behalf of the Counseling Center here in Southern Ohio. I mean, we treat, 1,200 individuals a year, and everybody's different. I've had clients that, they're on MAT for a few weeks, and they're ready to come off, and they're successful. I mean, they're motivated to come off, and they're ready. I've had individuals stay on it for a long amount of time and still be successful, and I've had people stay on it for a long amount of time and then not be successful for a variety of reasons. So, again, I think just kind of everyone's different. I think the trick to all this is what's very important is how well is that individual getting integrated back in the community.
Hmm.
I think a lot of times, the medication is very important, but it's also kind of like a puzzle piece. It's a piece of a bigger picture. Are they getting integrated back into society? Do they have a driver's license?
Hmm.
Do they have a safe, sober place to live?
Yeah.
Are they getting integrated back in with family members and friends and support? And if they have a slip up, is there a place that they can go safely? So, I'm always a little hesitant just to kind of go all in on the medication.
Mm-hmm.
Medication's important, but it's also just, again, it's kind of like think of it as a tool belt. It's one of your tools on the belt.
Barbara, is that sort of what you're shooting for, is see it as a reliable tool in your tool belt?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I would say it's the most effective tool that we know from so many studies. There's no doubt about it. But do other people also need other tools? A lot of the time, yes. The only issues that I really see are when people are forced to use all of the tools when they don't want all of the tools, and that includes medicine. I don't think anyone should ever be forced to use the medicine, by the way, if they don't want it.
Mm-hmm.
Just like I don't think they should be forced to go to a 12-step group if they want it. And then the other problem I see is people affirmatively being told, don't use the thing that, by the way, we have the best evidence for.
April Caudill, what about your experience at the Hope Resource Center?
I would say, one, that I would speak as a parent first that did have children that did the MAT. You know, I had the Vivitrol and the Suboxone with my two children that struggled with addiction.
And Vivitrol, by the way, is naltrexone, right?
Right.
Right, okay. So
my son, that he's 6 years, and he's been off the Vivitrol for a year. He's in college. He's doing well. He's very productive. Now, it took 2 years to get him there, mm-hmm. But we do have him there. And you know, we did struggle with Suboxone. We did lose a child to addiction. You know, there's the pros and cons to everything, but I really think it's an individual's choice and their professional, you know, counselor or a doctor that's going to guide them in the correct avenue that they need to go in. Because I think that every one of them has a positive. They're just not right for everyone, each and every one of them. Some need nothing and can do the 12 steps, but some do need help. And I would say with the women that come into the Hope Resource Center, you know, they start off with just getting them, you know, they're scared and they don't want to do anything. So we're just encouraging them to go one route and to get them resources to get them there.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. Betty in Pickerington, you're on the air. Hi, Betty.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, sure. You know, I wanted to comment. I'm not sure, you know, what the scientific evidence is, but I know that among the community of marijuana advocates, there is an overwhelming anecdotal evidence of folks just like myself who have used marijuana to get off of opiates. I just know that everybody's talking about switching from one dependency to another. And I actually only used marijuana for about a year and a half. I had my leg reconstructed. I was on very, very heavy amounts, but I was clinically dependent on opiates. Mm-hmm. And they just kept trying to up my dose and up my dose. And I was losing myself. And then they also added benzodiazepines to the mix. Mm. So I had these two really heavy clinical dependencies. And my friends convinced me to give marijuana a try, and it saved my life. And I'm no longer using it at all. It's not dependent. It changes your lifestyle. It changes your mindset. It helps you understand how to deal with your pain. And I just feel like that needs to be part of the conversation.
Dr. Barbara Andreka Christou, what about marijuana? Again, it's another thing that is kind of misunderstood.
Well, there honestly, at this point, and I'm really happy to hear that the caller is doing well, but we just don't have the evidence that it's an effective treatment mm-hmm. for any substance use disorder. I really strongly believe that public policy, healthcare providers, the community in general should be putting a lot of effort behind expanding those things that we have a mountain of evidence for. I mean, there may be right now anecdotal evidence about marijuana, and quite possibly in the future there would be more. I don't mm-hmm. know. But what we do have in contrast is a mountain of evidence for these medications that we were discussing earlier. So I would be wary about deterring listeners or people who are going through recovery from switching from something that we have a lot of evidence for to something that we just don't have the evidence for right now.
I just have about a minute left, and Andy Albrecht, I'm sorry. I really wanted to hear from those callers, but have you experienced from where you sit at the Counseling Center in Portsmouth barriers to getting people the appropriate amount of access to medically assisted treatment, cost barriers, barriers in the recovery community, the criminal justice system, or insurance companies?
Yes, I think access has always been kind of an ongoing issue. I mean, if you think about all other forms of healthcare, if I need treatment, you know, if I'm sick today or my daughter's sick today, the reality is there's a place I can go right now. You know, whether it's the emergency room or urgent cares. Now we can argue if that's the best way to administer health care through like a urgent care or emergency room setting. But the reality is at the end of the day, I can get access. Now, you know, drug and alcohol treatment, mental health services, the unfortunate thing, it's not really set up like that. I mean, finding services like right now, mm-hmm. you know, it kind of starts that whole apparatus where I start calling places and, you know, today's March the 4th and they give me an appointment on April the 7th.
Right.
But that's an eternity from now. I mean, I can be incarcerated by then, or overdose, or back in the emergency room, or just kind of fall off the grid for a while. And I think, you know, that's a real issue.
Yeah. Andy, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We're running out of time, and I want to say thanks to you, Andy Albrecht, Executive Director at the Counseling Center, April Caudill, Executive Director at the Hope Resource Center, and Dr. Barbara Andreka Christou, author of The Opioid Fix, America's Addiction Crisis and the Solution They Don't Want You to Have. Thanks to all of you today for this conversation. Thanks to the great callers. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.